Hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. This is Home in Progress, sponsored by Repcolite Paints and Benjamin Moore. And yeah, it's Thanksgiving weekend. How was your Thanksgiving? I probably about it. I should have wished everybody a happy Thanksgiving last weekend. But womp, somebody didn't think of that. I'm doing all this other heavy lifting with my brain so I can bring good stuff to you on the show. And I didn't even think of that. So happy Thanksgiving belatedly. Most of my cards that I send, most of my birthday wishes, most of the things that I send to other people, I have to add the word belatedly, because as much heavy lifting, I'm using air quotes there, as much heavy lifting as my brain does, like I just hinted at earlier, I don't really think there's a whole lot of heavy lifting going on. My brain just kind of phones it in, does what it's going to do, and I have to say belatedly a lot if I even remember to wish people a happy birthday or whatever. So happy Thanksgiving, happy belated Thanksgiving. What are you all doing today? Are you setting up your Christmas stuff? Are you putting up Christmas lights? Are you dealing with leaves on the yard? I think that's what I'm going to be doing at my house, dealing with leaves on the yard. Maybe you're just crashing. Well, on the show this week, we're going to kind of just crash. We're going to put strict, legit home improvement stuff on hold, and we're going to have a bit of a holiday episode. I've got some really interesting stuff regarding the psychology of cozy, for example. We're going to be talking about that, the psychology of cozy. Maybe that sounds really dumb. Chances are it does. But I'm really excited about this segment. You know, how can rooms that are decorated with the same main colors and with similar decor, how can they produce different results? You know, one can feel cozy and inviting. The other can feel, weirdly sterile or cold. What in the world is going on there? Shouldn't color choices determine the feel of the room? Well, there's more to it than just color choices. And we're going to talk about what it takes to make the cozy, inviting holiday spaces that we all want. And that's coming up. I also want to talk about the traditional Thanksgiving color palette. You know, I know Thanksgiving is past, but it's just past. So I can still do this. And really, when you think about it, where did that come from? You know, the traditional colors that we associate with Thanksgiving, where did that come from? Seems like a really easy answer, but the chances are, if you think you know what it is, you're probably wrong. I think the answer is going to surprise you. We'll get to that. But first, I want to talk about a room in the American house, you know, the standard, the usual, the typical American house that reached its golden age, its absolute peak in popularity, largely because of Thanksgiving. Okay, what room in the American home reached its golden age largely because of Thanksgiving? It's not the bathroom. You know, that's always been popular. You know, ever since they moved the bathroom indoors, it's been a favorite for many people. Well, actually, I think when they first moved the bathroom indoors, there were a lot of people thinking, this is nuts. What are we doing putting that in the house? That makes no sense. But after they got used to the idea and they realized how the plumbing would work and that it was actually, you know what I'm saying. I don't need to go into detail. It worked out. People really love that indoor bathroom. I don't think we're ever going back to putting those outside if we can help it. But that's not the room that I'm talking about anyway. That's just me wandering down a trail. The space that reached its golden age thanks to Thanksgiving is the formal dining room. And this is kind of fun. It's one of those stories where architecture, Victorian etiquette, women's magazines, and a turkey with all the trimmings collide in a really interesting way. Okay, let's go back. Early 1800s. You know, in a typical American home at that point, middle class or below, there wasn't a dining room. Instead, you did all your cooking, all your eating, your working, your playing, sometimes even your sleeping in the same one or two rooms. You know, a permanent room whose only job was to sit there and wait patiently for dinners to be served would have been insane. You know, a complete waste of space. Even wealthy medieval Europeans, you know, people with fancy, funny accents and wealth, even they didn't have dining rooms, at least not the way that we picture them. You know, they had great halls, you know, with great big trestle tables that went up for the feast and then they came down afterwards. Eating and meals and sharing a table really weren't things that dramatically changed architecture. But things start changing in the 1840s and the 1850s, you know, slowly and mostly among the well-off. So I wouldn't have seen this if I were living back then. But the well-off started to see this change, you know, and it happened as Victorian ideas about refinement and privacy start to take hold. And this is also when the Victorian belief in separate spheres emerged. You know, this is basically the idea that men belonged in the public world while women managed the home. You know, all of that's coming about. And that mindset starts pushing houses towards more specialized rooms. All right, so the dining room starts to kind of pick up a little bit because of that. Then you've got etiquette writers like Catherine Beecher and Eliza Leslie, and they're arguing that the sights and the smells of cooking should be hidden from the guests. Well, in some instances, that's absolutely true. You know, depending on how good you are at those things, maybe the sights and smells of cooking, it's not something you want your guests to see. You don't want them to see how the sausage is made. You know, figuratively there. Sometimes I'll make a meal and I'll think, boy, I'm glad none of the kids saw how I put that together. Anyway, you know what I'm saying? I don't think that's what they were getting at. I think they were being a little more prim and proper when they were saying that those things should be kept from the guests. You know, they were saying that a proper family needed a dedicated space to display civility. Right. And that place would be something like the dining room. It's uncivil in the kitchen where everything is just going nuts. You're killing the chicken or whatever. But in the dining room, everybody's got their civil clothes on and we're all acting cool. Right. So that's where things are. And because those ladies are saying it, and they were like, you know, I should give a quick scoop on these ladies, Catherine Beecher and Eliza Leslie. You know, when they wrote things, they were basically the Victorian equivalent of lifestyle influencers, like good ones. Their books were bestsellers. Families treated their advice the way many folks treat, you know, like a top HGTV designer today. Like it was the official word on how a proper home should look and run. So if Beecher and Leslie said it, it was gold. And so when they say, you know, that dining rooms are important or that this space for civility is important, well, the wealthiest homes start adding true dining rooms to their layouts, to their architecture, to their homes. But here's where it gets really good. The dining room doesn't become common, you know, doesn't become something that the hoi polloi, you know, the common folks had in their homes until after the Civil War. And Thanksgiving was absolutely key in bringing it about. Now, it all starts when good old Honest Abe, Honest Abe Lincoln, makes Thanksgiving a national holiday in 1863, but it really catches on in the late 1880s and 1890s and into the early 1900s when women's magazines, you know, Godey's Ladies' Book, Ladies Home Journal, Good Housekeeping, when these magazines turn Thanksgiving into this elaborate, aspirational, once-a-year domestic extravaganza that we all recognize now. Now, those magazines that I was talking about, they didn't just give you recipes and stuff. They gave you full-page spreads of perfectly set tables, you know, centerpieces, the correct distance between fork and plate. And crucially, they gave you photographs of beautiful dining rooms with settings for a large gathering of guests. Now, we get down on social media today a little bit, and maybe rightly so in some regards. But man, I know you all heard what I just said about those magazines and instantly thought, or at least a lot of you did, you instantly thought, hey, wait a minute, kind of sounds like Facebook and Instagram. You know, the same photo shoots, you know, the same perfection displayed, the same guilt induced because my home doesn't look anything like that home. Yep, all of that was the same, even back then. And suddenly, middle-class families realized their homes and their stuff and their lives were all garbage. They're all inadequate, right? I'm joking a little bit, but really, they did face this kind of a dilemma. They were seeing those magazines and seeing what a real Thanksgiving was supposed to look like. You know, that's the idea that's being conveyed. And they were flummoxed. They were bewildered. They were perplexed. You know, where do you go and seat, you know, 12, 16, 20 people without cramming everybody into the kitchen where we're making all the food? We're killing the chickens or the turkeys or whatever. We can't do that in there. They can't see all of that. We can't fit them in there. Where do we go? Do we put them in the parlor? They might spill gravy all over the sofa. That would stink. Then they went back to those magazines and looked closer, and suddenly the light went off. It was clear. There it is. It's a special room for eating stuff. That's what we need. We need a room that's nicer than the kitchen, but not as nice as the parlor. We need an in-between room that's built for eating things, for cramming food into our face. And America answered that call, that need, answered with the dining room. You know, built-in china cabinets, plate rails, swinging doors to hide the kitchen chaos, massive oak tables that could extend forever. Go online and dig up plans for any of the old Sears kit houses or the layout for any Craftsman bungalow, any four square from 1895 to 1925. You know, if you look at houses in that range, the dining rooms are going to be front and center. You know, before then, it wasn't really a thing in house layouts. Afterward, it's the heart of the design. So in the end, Thanksgiving didn't just use the dining room. You know, we didn't just have Thanksgiving and thank goodness we've got a dining room for it. It was kind of one of the key elements, and the promotion of Thanksgiving in those magazines is what made the dining room essential, or kind of required for, which is exactly what essential means, for the common people. Remember, the rich people already had one. The fancy people had one. But the hoi polloi, the regular folks, the Dans among us, they didn't have one until, man, we started seeing Thanksgiving promoted in those magazines, and we wanted that space. And then, all of a sudden, you know, after a number of years, we all changed our minds. You know, starting in the 1930s, but especially after World War II, the formal dining room kind of starts to go away. By the 1990s, the 2000s, pretty much it's disappeared from new house plans entirely. But there was that span of time when the dining room reigned supreme, and a big reason that it came to the forefront was because of Thanksgiving. All right, so now you've got that information, you're that much smarter. Now let's shift gears and talk about the origin story behind the Thanksgiving color palette. Do you know how we ended up with oranges and browns and greens as the colors of Thanksgiving? I bet you think you know, but I bet you're wrong. We're going to get to the right answer right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. You know, people often think of paint as just another line item on the project supply list. But here's the thing. Everything you do, every hour of prep, every stroke of the brush, all comes down to the quality of the paint. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. Let's start this segment, this brilliant segment, with a pop quiz. When you picture Thanksgiving, what colors do you see? All right, think it through. It's not much of a pop quiz. Most of us are going to have the same answers. Burnt orange, harvest gold, rusty browns, you know, that unmistakable kind of muddy green color that seems to fill in all the gaps, kind of ooze around everything else. Those are the colors we picture. Here's a tougher question. Why? You know, why are those the traditional colors of Thanksgiving? What do you think? Well, I always figured that it had something to do with the fall colors that are outside, right? Orange pumpkins, you know, leaves that are turning colors, grass that isn't healthy anymore. It's not that healthy green anymore. It's kind of a little bit muted, a little bit sickly, but it really works with the orange and the other colors. You know, that's where I figured it came from. Well, here's something that really caught me by surprise. Our traditional, air quotes, traditional Thanksgiving colors aren't really all that traditional. Instead, they're a mid-century invention. Basically, they were locked in place during the late 1960s and early 1970s. And why? Why were they locked in place back then? Can you guess? Yet another question for everybody to think about. Why back then were those colors locked in place? And why did they, from that point on, become the traditional colors? Well, think back to homes in the late 60s and the early 70s. Maybe you lived it. Maybe you can imagine it from pictures. Anything jump out at you? Well, at that point, those colors, those traditional Thanksgiving colors, they were colors that perfectly matched everybody's kitchen appliances, their shag carpet, their wallpaper, their paneling. Pretty much everything in their home was composed of those colors. You know, the common misconception is that we're decorating, when we do Thanksgiving decorating, we're decorating with the colors of autumn. But really, we're just using the exact color scheme of a 1971 Frigidaire. Now, I know that's maybe a leap, sounds like a leap. And maybe you doubt, you're tempted to doubt what I'm saying. But hold on, I've got proof. Not just shooting off at the mouth here. I've got proof. Before the 1950s, Thanksgiving wasn't really one of those decorating holidays. Not like it is now. You know, Christmas got the lights, Easter got the pastels, and Thanksgiving got, you know, a turkey and a white tablecloth. Maybe some real leaves if you were fancy. The color came from the food, not the craft store. Things start to change after World War II. Glossy magazines and department stores begin branding every holiday. We talked about that a little bit in the last segment in those magazines. But even then, even though they're demonstrating what Thanksgiving should look like all the way through the 50s, the look was still muted. You know, lots of tan, lots of soft yellow, lots of beige. And then the 1960s hit, and America falls hard for earth tones. You know, Harvest Gold refrigerators, which, yeah, came out a little earlier, but they really came to the forefront in the mid-60s. They were big. Avocado green stoves, burnt orange sofas, brown paneling, gold shag carpet, all of that stuff. That's what fills our homes. And here's something to think about and, you know, to help understand my bigger point. When we're talking about a gold refrigerator or an avocado stove or a burnt orange sofa, we're not talking about things that are in this year and out next year. Or a better way to say it would be, even if these things were out next year, they weren't cool next year, who's replacing them, right? We don't buy ovens and refrigerators and couches and install carpet only to change it with the next trend. Most of us don't. You know, once people put these in their homes, they live with them for a good long time, as long as we can. We want to eke out as much life as we can out of that stove because we don't want to buy another one. So with that reality in place, there was a little marketing genius stuff going on. When paper goods companies and dime stores started rolling out the very first Thanksgiving-only plates, you know, napkins, tablecloths, candles, things like that in the late 60s, when that started to come about, they deliberately picked colors that would look perfect next to your Harvest Gold range and that avocado dishwasher sitting in three quarters of American kitchens. It wasn't about fall leaves. It was about not clashing with the refrigerator or the paneling or the carpet or the stove. Well, by the early 1970s, that palette was set in stone, and the kids that ate off of those plates, you know, through those years, they grew up, they had their own families, and when they went looking for Thanksgiving decor, those are the colors that felt like Thanksgiving. That feels like home. That feels like grandma's house. That feels like tradition. Of course, eventually the appliances died. The shag carpet got ripped out. The paneling got replaced. But that Thanksgiving palette, that stayed forever. I think it's here forever. You know, today we've abandoned a fair amount of those tones. We don't see all of those. They had some resurgence times, and maybe they're coming back a little bit, but few people are putting Harvest Gold backsplashes in their new kitchen. But if you walk into any craft store, you know, in October, you do that and it's 1971, 1969, all over again. Orange and brown as far as you can see. Influencers and designers, they periodically try to break free from this lockdown Thanksgiving palette. And they try to bring in deep jewel tones, maybe creamy neutrals, some elegant whites, all of that. It works. It does work, but it doesn't really catch on. And it doesn't catch on because it's not Thanksgiving. That's just not Thanksgiving. Thanksgiving is probably the most nostalgic holiday we have. It's literally about recreating the past. And for two generations of Americans, that past looked like a sunset-colored KitchenAid and a brown dining room wall. So this year, the other day, a couple days ago, when you set out the orange napkins and the gather sign in that familiar, you know, golden shade, you weren't channeling the pilgrims like we think we were. You weren't even channeling autumn. You were actually dialed in on the appliance aisle at Sears sometime around 1969. All right, creating cozy spaces in our homes. How is it that two spaces using the same colors and largely the same kinds of decor can have completely different end results? One can feel cozy and inviting, the other just feels off. How can that happen? Well, there's an interesting psychology behind the idea and the concept of cozy, and we're going to talk about all the different things you need to know so that you can pull it off flawlessly. We're going to get to all of that right after this. Home in Progress is brought to you by Repco Light Paints and Benjamin Moore. Think about it. You spend hours prepping, sanding, taping, and then finally painting. Don't throw all that work away with an inferior product. The paint isn't just another supply. The paint is the project. Make sure it's the best. All right, right now I want to talk about something you've probably experienced 100 times, but maybe you never understood it. Here's the deal. You walk into somebody's house, you know, during the holidays, and instantly you feel it, you know, the sense of, oh my goodness, this is cozy, this is perfect, this is really nice. There's just something about a space like that. You know, we know it when we walk into one. My Grandma Hansen's house was this way during the holidays. You just walk in and everything about it makes you want to stay. You want to sit there. You want to get a little cup of tea, or you want her to give you 7-Up like she used to do, and maybe a bowl of the little chocolate covered graham cracker cookies that the elves make, right? She always had those for us kids. Anyway, you walk in and you just want to exist in that space for a while. Right? And then you walk into another house. Maybe it's your own home. Maybe it's somebody else's, but maybe it's your own. And you've got the same ingredients, right? Because you're trying to do what grandma did. It works so well at grandma's house. So I buy all the same things and I put them in my house. You know, the tree, the lights, the decorations. And yet it just feels wrong. You know, something about it isn't right. It's cold. It's sterile. It doesn't live. It doesn't breathe. Whatever. It's a very well-decorated room, but it just doesn't feel right. You know, something's going on. What's the difference? Well, of course, it's not the money spent. It's not how many decorations are put out. It's definitely not about blasting more twinkle lights all over the place. There's a psychology of coziness. And, you know, we talk about the psychology of color. There's a psychology of coziness. And once you understand it, you're never going to look at holiday decorating the same way again. This is really good stuff. That's a big claim. You know, once I get through this segment, I am going to change the way you think about holiday decorating forever. That's big stuff. You know, that's big stuff. So let's see if I can back it up. And I want to start by clearing up a few big misconceptions right off the bat. First off, cozy isn't the same as decorated. All right, cozy and decorated, not the same thing. A room can be packed with garland. It can be full of, you know, the nutcracker things, those little bearded men that sit on the shelves. It can be full up with Santas, you know, strung all over with mistletoe and ornaments, and it can still feel cold. So cozy isn't the same as decorated. Cozy isn't just warm colors. That's another misconception. You know, I've been in rooms with red and gold everywhere that still feel sterile and kind of cool. You know, just they don't feel right. And I've been in rooms with cool whites and grays that feel warm and inviting. Now, to be clear, the colors that we choose definitely can play in to making a space or helping make a space feel warm or cool, inviting or sterile. The colors really can play into that. They can make it easier or they can make it more difficult to get a cozy space. You know, colors do help here, but just putting warm colors on a wall doesn't mean you've achieved your goal. That's what I'm trying to get at. It's not just warm colors that make something cozy. All right, third misconception. Cozy isn't just soft things. You know, pillows, blankets, plush stockings, you know, all of those things. They can help, but if everything else feels staged or stiff, softness alone isn't going to save you. So if it's none of those individual ingredients, what is this mystical cozy that we're looking for? Well, it turns out both designers and environmental psychologists, there really is such a thing. Environmental psychologists and designers have dug into this, and the science behind coziness is really, really specific, and it's really intuitive once you hear it. So the first principle that I've got for you, get your notepads out. This is all gold. Everything that is going to spew from my mouth from this point on, sheer holiday goodness and gold. You're going to want to be writing it down, or you're going to want to find the podcast so you can revisit this in all its glory. All right. The first principle that designers look at is something called refuge and prospect. All right. The instinctive human preference for spaces that feel sheltered, but still give us a good view of what's around us. You know, refuge, feeling sheltered. Prospect, being able to see what's around us. It's an ancient thing and it's hard coded in us. So put simply, cozy is a balance of being tucked in, but not boxed in. It's why people gravitate towards corners in rooms, not because we're naughty And we got to be put in the corner. Maybe we spent so much time in the corner as a child being naughty that maybe some people gravitate towards corners for that reason. Like in Back to the Future, where Uncle Joey, you know, spent so much time in his little playpen that he never really wanted to be out of a playpen. So when he got old, the only playpen he could find was jail. You know, maybe that. But really, you know, whether we've spent tons of time in corners or in playpens or whatever, we do gravitate towards corners. We gravitate towards breakfast nooks, towards fireplaces, and kitchen gathering spots. It's why nobody stands in the dead center of a giant living room at a party. It's just weird. And we're wired to seek protected zones, someplace where we've got, you know, we know what's behind us, and we can keep an eye out on what's in front of us. And we're not thinking that as we're experiencing these spaces, but psychologically, deep down, that's what's going on. So during the holidays, this becomes even more important to think about so you can build it into what you put together in your space. You know, a massive open concept great room can look really impressive, right? But it rarely is going to feel cozy. There's just too much openness, too much of a good thing, too much vertical space, not enough psychological shelter. But break that room into smaller retreat zones. You maybe pull a chair up by the fireplace or a couple of chairs by a fireplace. You create a reading corner by a window. You set up a small table for puzzles or cocoa or whatever. And you do that, and suddenly the room starts to feel welcoming again. And here's something fun. The Christmas tree itself can create a refuge zone. It defines a corner. It gives people a reason to gather, and it kind of anchors the room emotionally. So refuge and prospect. Keep that in mind as you're putting your spaces together, especially if you're working in a great big open concept space. All right, another aspect of coziness has to do with ceiling height. And in fact, ceiling height is one of the most overlooked aspects. You know, high ceilings are beautiful, they're dramatic, they're impressive. You know, the shorter we are, the more amazing they are. You know, we can't even see all the way up into them sometimes, but they're not cozy, right? They're expansive, they're not intimate. And that's why lower levels, you know, despite their quirks, they often feel incredibly cozy during the holidays because they've got lower ceilings, they're smaller rooms, there's just more psychological enclosure. Now, if you've got high ceilings and, you know, that's just in your space, you can't exactly lower them. Not inexpensively anyway, not practically. But here's what you can do. You can lower the perceived ceiling height with decor, with decorations. You know, when you put garland along the top of your windows, you're creating a horizontal line that breaks up the wall height a little bit. That helps. When you hang a wreath or you put up wall decorations or artwork or whatever, you're bringing the visual weight down from the ceiling. The Christmas tree itself helps with this. You know, it's a vertical element that fills some of that empty airspace. If you're looking for solutions with paint, if you've got the time and energy to get this project wrapped up before Christmas, one of the easiest tricks to lower a ceiling is to paint it the same color as your walls. You know, extending the wall color onto the ceiling blurs the line of where the one stops and the other starts. It's a really, really easy trick that works really, really well. And it's not as bold as painting that ceiling, you know, another color entirely. You know, so you're not really stepping outside your comfort zone in a huge way in this regard, but you are achieving that a little more of a cozy feel by bringing that ceiling down visually a little bit. Victorian homes understood this concept really instinctively. You know, they had picture rails, plate rails, wainscoting, crown molding, you know, all these horizontal elements that broke up the wall height and made the rooms feel more human-scaled, more people-sized. You know, modern open-concept homes with their huge soaring ceilings and their minimalistic trim, architecturally, they're working against coziness right from the start. However, if you do have those spaces, you definitely can get creative and can bring the scale down, you know, and bring it back into the cozy zone by doing some of the things that we talked about. All right. Moving on. And this is probably the single most important element of coziness. And it's one that most people get wrong. It's the lighting. So this is the third thing I want to talk about, the lighting. And specifically, we want to focus on the idea or the concept of layered lighting. Now, cozy spaces, they almost never have a single light source. They definitely don't rely on overhead lighting. You know, think about the coziest room that you've ever been in, you know, at any time, but during the holidays or whatever. I bet if you can picture it, you know, if you can picture this, maybe you've got problems, you know, because I can't picture what the lighting was like. But I bet if you could go back in time and visit yourself and see yourself in that cozy setting, you'd notice that the overhead lights were off. or dimmed or something like that. They weren't blasting. You know, instead, what you probably would find, rather than overhead lights, you'd find multiple light sources at different heights and with different intensities. You know, the Christmas tree lights, the fireplace, maybe some candles on the mantle, table lamp in the corner, another lamp on the on a side table over here. Basically, everything is softer, more diffused, more varied when you light a room like that. This is what lighting designers call light layering, and it's the opposite of how a lot of people light their homes day to day. You know, during the day, we want bright, even light. You know, unless the home's really messy, I kind of like to keep things dim so I can't see into the corners. But most people want bright, even light so we can see clearly, we can work efficiently, we can walk through the space without tripping over things. You know, we use overhead lights or big, bright lamps to flatten everything out. But for coziness, if that's what you're shooting for, you want the opposite. You want multiple pools of softer light that create depth and shadow and visual interest. You want your eye to kind of move around the room and have different areas to discover. Sounds kind of weird, but if you think it through, it makes sense. And don't worry about the shadows that you're creating, because that's, you know, instantly what crops in my mind. What about the shadows? The shadows actually make the space feel warmer and more intimate. You know, when everything is evenly lit, it feels kind of clinical. Right? When there are gradations of light and dark, it's going to feel more cozy. All right. Another thing to think about. Cozy, the whole idea of cozy, engages multiple senses. And touch is huge, even when you're not actively touching stuff. You know, when we look around a room, our brain is constantly asking, what does that thing feel like? What is that going to feel like? And you know I'm right. You may not know I'm right initially, but think about it for a second. Look around the room that you're in right now. Somewhere in the back of your mind, you're instantly evaluating every surface. Is it cold? Is it warm? Is it soft? Is it rough? You know, most of the time, those thoughts sit below the surface. But once you notice them, you can't unnotice them. They're always there. And that little mental reflex, that little mental activity that we go through, just naturally has a huge impact on whether a space feels cozy or not. You know, in general, smooth, glossy materials, glass, metal, plastic, those things, they're going to read as colder to our brains. All right. Soft textured things, wool, velvet, linen, even natural wood grain, all of those things are going to just read as warmer. The brain's going to make that judgment way before we reach out and touch anything. And when we do touch them, our nervous system's going to double down on the sense of warmth and comfort that we were expecting to find. Now, that doesn't mean that you should get rid of all the brass bells and glass ornaments that you've got, because hard, shiny materials absolutely have a place. Cozy rooms need contrast. The trick is making sure the harder, colder textures are balanced with enough soft, warm ones to give your eye something comforting to land on. And that's why holiday decor leans so heavily on things like knit stockings, quilted table runners, velvet ribbons, right? Rough wooden ornaments, felt, wool, cotton, all of those things. Those materials don't just soften the room visually, they soften it emotionally, maybe, if that's what I'm trying to say. Basically, what I'm getting at is cozy isn't just a visual experience. It's something we touch and feel, even when that touching is happening only with our eyes. Now, I know that's a little bit weird, but if you think it through, I think it makes sense. All right, next up on our checklist to achieving cozy spaces is this. Every truly cozy space, you know, every truly cozy holiday space has a smell. And I mean that in a good way. You know, pine needles, cinnamon, cookies, a candle that smells like Christmas Eve, you know, a wood fire, whatever your family's version is. You know, scent is incredibly powerful. And we all know this, but it's incredibly powerful because it bypasses, you know, logic and it goes straight to memory and straight to emotion. And that's why we can walk into a house sometimes and a particular smell will hit us and it instantly transports us back to being, you know, 7 years old at grandma's house or whatever. You've all had those experiences where a smell has brought back incredible memories, you know, good memories, bad memories sometimes. But smells do that. They have that power. So here's the key. Cozy rooms have a gentle scent that feels warm, familiar, and inviting. All right, a gentle scent. And that scent can come from anywhere. A real tree, a simmer pot, your oven, a really good candle. You know, real scents are great because they change over time. Baking cookies, they smell different when the cookies are raw, when they're baking, and when they're cooling. You know, and our brains pick up on that. You know, it's subtle, but our brains pick up on that. But a well-chosen candle, that can do the job too. Just be sure that if you do use artificial scents, go for the ones that smell warm and natural and they're a little bit gentle. Right? Especially if you're having large groups of people over. Go for the gentle scents because not everybody has the same fortitude for smells as other people. Yeah, the big goal here is avoiding scents that feel harsh, overly perfumey, or really chemically sharp because those pull the brain out of that relaxed, cozy state. The big thing to keep in mind is that scent is powerful when it comes to evoking emotions. You know, we know that, but keep that in the forefront of your mind here. It shouldn't be an afterthought when you put your room together. And I know for me, it completely is an afterthought. It is not front and center. I'm too busy worried about all the decor, how things will look. I'm not thinking about the smell, but it really is as important as the decor. So think about incorporating scents as you get the space ready for your party or for just your own family's enjoyment. You know, a real tree or real greens, that's going to have instant payoffs if that's something you can pull off. A pot of spices simmering on the stove. I mentioned that. That can work really well. A pie that you baked earlier, right? That was always a trick when you're showing a house. You bake an apple pie or something like that because it makes the house feel homey. Well, that's exactly what we're talking about here. Lean into that. You know, even opening a window to let in a little cold, crisp air just for a few minutes, that can really, really play into the space and really create that cozy feel that you're looking for. You know, the big thing here, remember that scents matter more than you probably think they do. All right, next one. Here's where I might lose some of you. I understand that, but I'm going to say it anyway. Truly cozy spaces are designed for people and not for, you know, photography. And there's a big difference between those two goals. There's an American interior designer named Sister Parrish. We talked about her on the show a few months ago or so. She decorated for some of the wealthiest families in America, including the Kennedy White House. But one of her core principles was creating spaces that felt lived in. You know, she'd mix all kinds of priceless antiques with comfortable sofas that you could actually sit on. She'd put beautiful fabrics in rooms where kids and dogs would be running around. Her spaces, they were sophisticated, but they were also practical for daily life. She was blending formal elements with casual comfort and casual items. And that's the big takeaway here. You can have a beautiful space that's also functional. You know, it's also people friendly. In fact, the most beautiful spaces are the ones that invite people in and invite you to use them, not the ones that make you afraid to touch anything. You know, we've all been in spaces where we feel afraid to touch anything, and it's not a place where you feel comfortable. It's not cozy. Even though it may look amazing, it's not cozy. It's not inviting. So during the holidays, this might mean crafting a space that looks like people actually live there and are actually, you know, celebrating. Not like a decorator came through for a photo shoot. You know, so books stacked on a coffee table as if somebody was just looking through them. That's a good thing. A blanket that's actually been used, not just artfully draped somewhere. Christmas cards, you know, displayed in a haphazard way rather than a perfect line. These aren't flaws. These are signs of life, and that's good. The best holiday decorating has intentionality, right? But it's also got, you know, kind of an organic chaos. The tree, for example. I'm really bad about this, but the tree, it's okay if some of the ornaments are beautiful and perfect and in line with a theme. And it's okay if other ones are a little bit ugly. Ugly but meaningful. You know, things the kids made, things that I hide because I don't want them messing up my perfect tree that I'm trying to create. I'm probably doing that the wrong way, right? Lean into some of that stuff that's got inherent, you know, emotional value to us. It's okay to have those things that aren't perfect. The mantle can have both expensive candlesticks and the stockings, you know, that aren't the nicest stockings anymore. But that's what you've used for years and years and years with the kids. There's nostalgia to that. And while it may not look perfect, it's going to be utterly cozy and utterly inviting. When spaces are too perfect, too staged, too matchy-matchy, they stop feeling like spaces where people actually live, and they start to feel like museum exhibits or magazine spreads. And museums, no matter how beautiful They are. They're not cozy. Magazines aren't cozy. You know, I think sometimes we get so caught up in making things look good. And believe me, I already said it. I get it. I do it. But we get so caught up in that that we forget to make things feel good. We create spaces that look perfect, but that nobody feels comfortable using. And really, at the bottom line, what's the point of that, especially during the holidays? The whole purpose of decorating is to create an environment where people want to gather and stay and be together. So if your decorations make people nervous about sitting down or touching things, you're actually working against your own goal there. Unless your goal is to make sure people don't touch a lot of your stuff. You know your family. Maybe that is the smarter play for you. But it's not going to be cozy, but at least your stuff's going to be good. Anyway, take that one for what it's worth and figure out how it fits with you. Now, all right, one last element that I'll mention is sound. And I'm not talking about just the question in your head of, should I play Christmas music or not? I mean the whole sound environment, the ambiance of the room. Because sound really can work for your cozy vibe, but it can actually also work against it. So think about fancy restaurants for a second. They put an unbelievable amount of effort and research into getting the sound right. You know, the music isn't too loud, it's never too close, and it fills the space without drowning out conversation. You're not always aware of it. You just feel comfortable. It feels right in that zone. And we've all been in restaurants where the sound is off and it pulls us out of the conversation, or we're shouting across the table or feel like we have to shout across the table. We definitely don't feel comfortable in those spaces. So remember that good sound creates a sense of warmth and hospitality in a place like that. And the same is true at home. So what does cozy sound sound like? Well, cozy sound is soft. It's going to be warm. It's going to be low pressure. It's not going to be silence, because silence can actually feel a little bit eerie, right? Silence is a little eerie. But it's also not going to be noise blasting at you. Obviously, not rocket science here. A cozy room is going to have a gentle backdrop, right? So fire crackling, maybe a kettle warming, quiet instrumental music drifting in from the next room, distant laughter, the subtle hum of the house just kind of doing its thing. All of that is good. All of those things are going to tell your brain that the space is alive, it's safe, it's steady, it's inviting, all of those things. What's going to kill a cozy vibe when it comes to sound? Well, TV noise is brutal on the cozy vibe. Loud music is brutal. Phone notifications, beeping appliances. You know, the microwave that nags at you. It just keeps beeping until you open the door, periodically. Anything sharp, digital, or repetitive. Those things pull you out of the moment. They grab your attention instead of supporting the atmosphere. A Christmas movie running loudly in the background. A lot of people, I've been there, it feels cozy to have a Christmas movie just playing on the tube, they're not really tubes anymore, are they? Just playing on the television, but it really can take away from that cozy atmosphere because the noise, the sound level of it can just take over the space. Phone notifications, they're instant mood killers, right? We're constantly attached to these phones. And they're constantly pulling us out with their little notifications, pulling us out of whatever we're engaged in at the time, whether it's a conversation or anything. I mean, phones, it's a major social thing to think about anyway. But in an event, at a party or something like that, where you're trying to create a cozy vibe, those dinging notifications, they nag at us. They pull us out of that vibe. So what can you do? Well, you got to work with the things that you can control. You can't control. I mentioned that, laughing, the sound of laughing conversation is something that really adds to the vibe. You can't control that. You can try, but that's not going to make for a very cozy, authentic party when you cue people when they're supposed to come in with a nice guffaw or a chuckle. So you can't control certain things, but you've got to focus on the things you can control. So turn off the things that are fighting you. Shut down that TV. If you can, unless you're actively watching it, turn off the TV, silence the phones. If you can get people to do that, if you can mute the microwave beeps, go for it. Reduce anything that feels sharp or electronic. add soft sound intentionally. You know, if you've got a real fireplace, great, lean into that. If not, electric fireplaces, fire sound apps, or even a small tabletop fountain, all of those things can create gentle background noise. Christmas music, that works wonderfully if it's instrumental and in another room. I know that sounds a little weird, but when the music comes from a nearby speaker, your brain feels like it needs attention. If there's vocals on it or lyrics on it, our brains naturally focus on the words. If the music's kind of coming from another room or very quietly from speakers, you know, strategically positioned in the room that you're in, if it's instrumental, you know, it just kind of fills in the gaps. It kind of just makes up that background. Like we talked about at the restaurants, you know, it's just that great setting, that great ambiance from that music. Just make sure that it's not overpowering the space. One last thing I'll say here is you can create your own soundscape if you want. You know, I've got a free app on my phone where I can mix fire crackling, wind, a little snowstorm, whatever I want. It's for sleeping. You know, it's to create noise so I don't wake up with every little sound in the house, because I wake up at every sound. So I've got to have some other kind of white noise kind of thing that drowns it out. Well, I found this app, and there's a million of them out there, but I can mix all these layers of sounds. I can get, snow blowing in on a Danish whatever. I mean, it's sound that's been captured all over the world. I don't even know how real that part is, but that's what they're telling me. But I can take all these pieces, and I can control how loud each one is, and I can create something that's got a fire crackling, wind blowing outside, whatever. All of that can really work to create this cozy ambiance that you're shooting for. Just make sure it's not playing too loud through your speakers. Look into those kinds of things. The big takeaway here is don't forget about sound. Cozy isn't just what you see, it's what you hear and what you don't hear. A few soft, warm sounds support the atmosphere. Sharp, loud, attention-grabbing sounds tear it down. You know, sound's invisible, but we feel it immediately, and it plays on, you know, our anxiety, or it comforts us. Sound has that power. So use it intentionally, and your whole space changes. All right, so what does all of this mean practically? Well, if you've decorated your house for the holidays already, or maybe you're going to do that today, and whenever you do that, if you notice that it's not feeling cozy yet, you know, as cozy as you want, here are some things to think about and try. First off, look at your lighting. Are the overhead lights on? Turn them off if you can. Dim them if you've got to have them on. Can you add other light sources, table lamps, you know, the lights from the tree, candles, something like that? Do what you can to create those pools of softer light. That's going to help a lot. Second, create refuge zones, right, within your larger spaces. Pull some chairs closer together near the tree. Set up a small table in a corner with some books and a lamp. Define smaller areas within the bigger room for people to gather at. Third, add texture. You know, get some throws, some pillows with different fabric textures, maybe a wool rug. Give the eye soft, tactile things to rest on, right? Create that warmth with the texture that you bring in. Fourth, think about scent. What does your house smell like? If the answer is nothing, or Febreze, or the dogs, consider adding some better smells, you know, real greenery, a simmer pot, baking something, you know, bring in a nice candle that's gentle. You don't want those overly perfumed smells. So think about smells. Fifth, think about sounds. Don't forget about sounds. And remember, it works both ways here. A little bit of sound is great. Too much sound can really detract. So find that balance and turn off some of those things that you don't need and kind of bring in some of the other ones that will help you out. Finally, and this one's maybe the hardest one, let it be a little bit imperfect. That's okay. It's okay if the blanket's rumpled. It's okay if the books are stacked up kind of off kilter. Let the space show signs of actually being used and lived in. That's really welcoming to people. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Home in Progress. If you like what you heard, consider subscribing to the show. That's really great. Leave us a review. That helps us out a ton. It helps other people find the show. And, you know, honestly, share the show with a friend. We can go old school here. Just share it. That would be really great. Let other people find the show and find out if they like it or not. You know, maybe it's the greatest gift you will give somebody this year is just an awareness of this show. Who knows? Maybe not, but it could be. All right, have a great week, everybody. For Home in Progress, I'm Dan Hansen. Thanks for listening.